Good morning. I'm Dr. Martin Kulldorff, the chair of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Today is June 25, 2025, and I'm pleased to call today's ACIP meeting to order.
You may remember back in June when the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, met. It was kind of a bigger deal than usual.
I'm very glad that there's so much interest in the work of this committee, and I want to especially welcome members of the public with us today remotely. It is wonderful that you take an interest in vaccines, medicine, and science.
This meeting, during which the board makes recommendations about things like what influenza strains should go in the fall flu shots and, you know, who should be first in line for COVID boosters, it comes and goes every year without many people paying attention.
ACIP recommendations have an impact on the health and lives of Americans from infancy to old age. Our recommendations cover the lives of over 70 million, mostly healthy children.
But in the weeks leading up to this year's meeting, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy had fired the entire board of vetted and respected vaccine experts and replaced them with people, many of whom were on the record vaccine skeptics, like Kennedy himself. So more people than usual were paying attention this year. I expected controversy, but what I didn't expect was to be jolted to attention by a brief presentation that was tucked into the agenda just after lunch of the first day and before any of the vaccine debates I actually tuned in for.
Yeah, so I'll be very brief. My name is Chris Braden. I'm the Principal Deputy Director for the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. There are over 800 pathogens that we're responsible for, some of which you know well and some of which are very exotic.
One of those pathogens has emerged as a looming threat to the U.S. southern border. It's called New World Screwworm,
which is making its way up from Central America into Mexico right now. It is mainly an animal disease. Investigation is led by USDA, but there is a human component where New World Screwworm can cause a very nasty meiosis.
Okay, that doesn't sound good.
That is basically an infestation of the maggots in skin and so forth, and they eat the live tissue.
Even worse than I imagined.
It is a threat right now to mostly animal agriculture, some human component in the United States as it makes its way up from Central America and Mexico. I'll stop there.
And we'll start there, because as it makes its way through Mexico, it's got a bullseye on Texas. And Commissioner of Agriculture Sid Miller says it's moving fast.
It's moved up within 350 miles of Texas. That's 100 miles a month. At that rate, if it keeps at that pace, it'll be here by November, November 15th.
New World Screwworm, its Latin name, Cochleomaia omnivorax, means man-eater. And the thing is, New World Screwworm was eradicated from the U.S. and Mexico decades ago. But like with measles, the eradication doesn't seem to mean what it used to. So it's headed this way, posing a threat to warm-blooded creatures of all kinds. That includes livestock, wildlife, pets, and people. What do we need to know? Well, let's dig in. From Texas Public Radio, this is Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio, committed to transforming the health of the community through a team that tackles problems from every angle, doing everything it takes to bring each patient the best possible outcomes, from teaching tomorrow's healthcare leaders to translating research into new treatments. UT Health San Antonio strives to make lives better. Learn more at everythingittakes.org.
the Texas Farm Bureau posted a video in June on all of its social media channels warning ranchers about New World screwworm.
They call it a screwworm because of the way it looks and its movement when it's on the animal. Like I say, it's eating you alive. It's like a piranha. It's going to come at you and it's attacking you with all its teeth. That's what these worms are doing. So imagine having these 300 worms like on you and they're just eating you small bits at a time.
Honestly, I'd rather not.
I know it's called screwworm, but in reality, it is a fly. When that fly lands the larvas, those larvas become a worm. That worm is what's starting to eat our animals alive.
That's Lizette Cuellar Olivares. She describes herself as a sixth-generation cattleman who ranches in both Texas and Mexico. The worm she describes, the screwworm, is actually a maggot. But unlike most maggots that feast on the dead, the screwworm has a taste for the living.
Whether it's your cattle, your horses, the coyotes, and it's going to look for wounds on an animal or blood. It's very specific what it targets. I don't know if people have the stomach for what they're going to see because it's literally an animal being eaten alive. The impact that it can have.
All right, so this is clearly the stuff of nightmares, and since it's fast approaching, we got to know more. And you find the top experts in the world in this kind of thing at Texas A&M, so that's where I reached out.
Yeah, it's Sonia Swiger. I'm an entomologist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. What do? Let's say I do livestock, veterinary, medical entomology. So basically help the public learn and educate them on biting insects of all kinds. So, and sometimes that spans quite a distance as we're talking about one that doesn't technically bite, but obviously causes a lot of problems.
This is not actually a worm.
So exactly. It's not a worm. But back in the day when we were learning about things, which, you know, this was over 100 years ago, so to speak, or even longer when they first identified it, it had this weird appearance. So it has this behavior where it will feed with its head down into the material it's feeding upon, which in this case is the flesh of an animal. And it looks kind of like it has been screwed in like a screw. So that's where that screw worm title kind of came from, even though, yeah, it's not technically a worm.
It kind of bores its head into an animal's flesh and its spine winds around its body, and it really does kind of look like a screw. And if it was just a worm, it might be less of a threat. But this maggot is able to cause problems across great distances right now because they come from a specific type of fly.
Yes, yes. So it is the larval stage, also referred to as a maggot, of a blowfly species. They're generally robust flies, metallic in color. And this one is different because it has a preference for laying its eggs on the wounds of animals that are still alive.
I've read that even tiny little abrasions, like the kind of breaks in the skin that you might never even notice, attract these flies.
Any little wound is susceptible. So we're talking even like a tick bite, which is extremely small. So you don't have to have these huge gaping wounds. So we're not thinking that people are going to be mistreating their animals and they're the ones being attacked. It can be the tiniest little nick. They could have run into barbed wire. Or they could hit each other and get a little nick. You could be working them and doing something that's very normal and they can get a little scratch. And those would all be susceptible.
Okay, so if a human doesn't notice and an infested animal doesn't get treated, do animals die?
Yes. And it depends on the size of that animal, but it is 1 to 2 weeks. Within 2 weeks, no matter what, that animal will be dead. It's not necessarily that like they consume the entire animal. It's more that the location where the eggs are first laid are usually on the head or on the belly, right? And those are going to be places that are very susceptible. So once the larvae start feeding, they're going to get to vital organs quickly and would cause the animal to die.
So that means if you're a rancher, you're going to have to be extra vigilant if this fly actually does make it back over the border.
And in Texas, we have very large plots of property in the southern half of the state where they're on many hundreds of acres, and it's already hard enough to get access to them. So now you're going to have to invoke more cowboys. And that's one big concern, is there's a lot less cowboys than there used to be back in the day to go out and help round up animals.
Which is one of the reasons that groups like the Texas Farm Bureau are making those videos like that one I played at the beginning of the show. This could get really expensive for them really quickly, and expensive for them means expensive for consumers, which is you and me. So let's talk a little bit about why we're even dealing with this, right? A new world screwworm has been eradicated in the U.S. for decades. But before that, Texas was home for these bothersome blowflies.
Yeah. So I think that they were technically here before it was colonized. And obviously, when we started to bring livestock in, that gave them a new host because, you know, most cattle weren't native to the America. Those were brought here. So they did open up that and provided a new host for them. And they were all in the Southwest. So the map shows them completely from Mississippi River west all the way to California.
So the western half of the South. And then in the 1930s, there was a devastating drought, the Dust Bowl, and livestock was starving. People were starving. And that's the kind of thing that drives migration, right? Many Americans became climate refugees to other parts of the country back then. And many ranchers moved their starving cattle to the Southeast.
And when they moved those cows there, because obviously there's much more grass and a lot more rain in that side, then they saw the exposure of the screwworms in that area. So they did bring the screwworms with them. So then we had all the southern states completely encased with them.
The USDA website called screwworm in the 1930s a plague, and it was costing the economy up to $10 million a year back then. That's real money. So they decided to try to come up with a way to stop it, right? And they did eventually come up with a way to reduce and eventually eliminate the population from the U.S. Here's what they did. They took a radioactive isotope of element number 27 on the periodic table, cobalt, and they sterilized these blowflies.
They use a process in which they basically have to mass rear the flies. And then when they get to the pupal stage, they expose them to the cobalt. And in that exposure, that breaks up chromosomes that makes them not able to have offspring.
All right, Sonia, when you say mass rear, you mean they breed a bunch of these blowflies in captivity, they sterilize them, and then they release them so they can, you know, go out in the world and try to mate and make babies, even though they can't.
So they still have to go out there and fake it, right? Act like I'm still doing everything I'm supposed to do. But the males give off non-viable sperm. So their sperm is no longer good to produce eggs. But the females don't realize it. So then when they release these males that are now sterile, they will mate with the wild females. The wild female will think, okay, I've achieved my goal, which is I mated and I'm now ready to go lay eggs. And she will, but her eggs will not ever hatch. So that's the concept of how we use it. And that's why we have to produce so many. And it's a really good tool.
Yeah, because over time, the flies were eradicated in the Southeast and then most of the Southwest and then Texas.
Texas just took longer because of Mexico. Because we had to finally get Mexico to eradicate them to keep them from coming back into Texas.
The USDA says New World screwworm was eradicated in the U.S. in 1966, but Swiger says there were screwworm problems in Texas until the late 70s.
I have folks that were working cows back then, or they worked with their grandpa. So we get firsthand stories, which is really cool to hear because I've, of course, never seen this fly. It was eradicated before I was born. So
no matter whether they were eradicated in the 60s or the 70s, they were eventually pushed down past what Swiger calls a biological barrier in the Darien Gap in Panama. So the Darien Gap is kind of a no man's land because it's in an area of dense jungle. There are no real roads. The terrain is extremely treacherous. And these flies tend to migrate with animals that tend to migrate with people. And not many people or animals are taking the risk of migrating through the gap. And in Panama, they still also breed and release sterile screwworm flies to keep the population down. But recently, folks started to detect some permeability in this biological barrier.
In 2023 is when they started to realize that Panama was getting cases west of the Darien Gap, basically into Panama, because the Darien Gap is basically the most eastern, I think, part of it that goes right into South America. So they started to notice something was happening then. A lot of stuff has happened in the last couple years, and it just kept moving.
So who or what is at greatest risk right now?
it is a huge impact to the livestock industry. And that was back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And now if we were to see the impact it would have to us now, we're looking at multi-billions of dollars, which is not something that we can sustain, obviously. It does change practices when it comes to how you raise your animals, what you do with your animals, how you work your animals, when you calve your animals. So it has a big impact to those type of behaviors, all things that people's systems are set up upon. And then you have to worry about incidences of when they get injured. And we say livestock because that's where we see the largest impact, but it's wildlife. We can't even really be prepared to control the wildlife issue that would happen with it because we can't get to the wildlife, right? We can sometimes see them, but most of the time they're off doing their own thing. They will attack deer, the males during the rutting season, which is when they're, you know, hitting each other, and then they're velvety. The velvet on their antlers starts to come off. That all becomes susceptible to attacks. And then you have the calving season for them too, which is also a susceptible time for the female. So huge impact to the deer industry. Plus then you have, you know, animals in general, and we have horses to worry about, which are our livestock, but they're more domesticated livestock. You know, they get injured very easily. Then you have dogs and cats, which will be targeted by these flies because they don't really have a preference for their host. They just go for the easiest target, so to speak. And then you have humans on top of that. And while humans are rare, because most of us do seek care for our wounds, we know when we're injured, we can tend to ourselves, and animals can't. They have to rely on us to do it for them. It still can happen. So it's definitely a big concern. And again, that's why we got rid of it in the first place.
Okay, so what kind of health threat does New World screwworm pose to humans?
Yeah, so the term is called meiosis. The fly will lay eggs on your body, and then those larvae will start to feed on you.
More on New World screwworm and human health when Petri Dish continues.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/BHC.
Independent journalism needs protection, now more than ever. Leaving a gift to TPR in your will helps ensure thoughtful, fact-based news has a future in Texas. Learn more at tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. Back in October 2024, the Centers for Disease Control hosted what's called a COCA call.
Good afternoon. I'm Captain Ibad Khan, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Office of Emergency Risk Communication at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
COCA hosts these informational sessions when there's an emerging health concern and the Federal Health Agency wants to let clinicians across the country know about it.
I'd like to welcome you to today's COCA call, Resurgence of New World Screwworm in the Americas, What Healthcare Providers Need to Know.
The CDC looks at the potential impacts of screwworm through the lens of human health.
New World screwworm causes significant morbidity in patients and can also contribute to mortality. There have been cases of returned travelers to the U.S. from endemic areas.
A medical officer in the Division of Parasitic Diseases and Malaria, Dr. Rebecca Chansey, went on to detail three cases in Americans who had traveled abroad and come home with screwworm. One was a 26-year-old woman who had spent a week at a resort in the Dominican Republic. The windows in her room had screens, so a fly didn't sneak in that way, but
she did fall asleep one night on the beach after drinking alcohol, and the next day noted some ear discomfort and sensation of movement inside of her ear. She removed a fly from her ear, and then pain and bloody discharge from the ear started one day later.
When she returned to the U.S., she was treated for a nasty infestation in her ear. They had to dig the maggots out, debride skin from inside her ear, and cleanse that whole area. Her eardrum was perforated, and that was repaired with a skin graft. She was put on a course of antibiotics. Not fun, but the alternative is significantly worse.
Death may occur due to secondary infections or as a result of extensive tissue destruction.
Right. So let's get back to Sonja Swiger at Texas A&M, an expert on New World screwworm. Sonja, tell me what can happen to humans who are infected with this particular blowfly larva.
Yeah, so the term is called meiosis, and the meiosis isn't exclusive for this fly, but what it means is it's the infestation of a living person with fly larvae. It's just like what we're talking about with animals. The fly will lay eggs on your body, and then those larvae will start to feed on you.
Yikes. Okay. So I listened to that COCA call back in October where they talked about travel-related cases in the U.S.
Yes. And a lot of those have been more like in the nose or around the mouth because those are easy exposure. So if you get a wound in your nose and you fall asleep in a place where they're located, they'll just go in there and lay the eggs and you won't even know they did it. So yeah, it's it is extremely unpleasant. I am not signing up for this one for sure.
Oh, no, because death is a possibility.
Yeah, and they'll just start feeding on the body. And if you don't seek proper care, it could lead your body to shut down. Again, it's not saying that that larva is going to like literally eat you to death. It's that your body will react to it, right? So your system will shut down because you're being fed upon by these larvae.
So we know that people who work and live around animals would be at higher risk because, like with bird flu, they're the ones who are in close proximity to the threat, but they are not the only ones at risk.
One of the big concerns is those that are homeless who don't have proper health care in the first place. So we don't want to see it come back and be a problem for them. And we don't want it to be a problem for our animals and dogs. Could be dog related. So people need to realize this isn't just a problem for those that live on farms. It's a problem for everybody. And we wouldn't be talking about it if it wasn't something that we felt was really concerning.
Right, right, right. Like my dog, she has a ton of fluffy fur. She looks like a Pomeranian. She isn't, but she looks like one. I would probably notice an injury because she's in my lap all the time, but something as small as a tick bite, I don't know. It might take me a minute. And of course, not everyone's pets live in their laps.
Exactly. And actually, the first stage of these larvae are so tiny that most people won't see them at all.
Dr. Chansey on the COCA call went to kind of great pains to be clear that the fly that laid its eggs in the young woman's ear was not in her hotel room when it happened. That woman had good screens, and theoretically, flies couldn't get into her room. It happened when she was sleeping outside. Now, Swiger mentioned the homeless just now, and of course, they often sleep outside. And they're vulnerable to all kinds of skin abrasions, just, you know, going on about their days. They often have poor health for a variety of reasons, and of course, limited access to healthcare. I mean, this could become a devastating problem for an already extremely challenged population. When we talk about illnesses that have an outsized impact on the poor, like mosquito-borne illnesses, I always try to mention that good quality window screens, not with holes or sewed up with patches, or just like open windows, can help a lot to decrease their risk. And in some countries, they're starting to have a lot of success fighting malaria with bed netting that has been treated with pesticides, so people are protected when they sleep. And these protections work. But a lot of economically distressed people, even in the U.S., don't have good screens in the rooms where they sleep. And with something that sounds as crazy as screwworm, Swiger says it's difficult to get people who don't have their livelihoods on the line, like farmers and ranchers who are paying attention, to take this threat seriously. She says some just don't believe it. Because it sounds crazy, right? And some think this is some kind of great conspiracy.
I do a lot of vector education as well on mosquito-borne diseases. And even with the diseases that happen here, it's still hard to get people to take an interest in it. So it's like, well, the chances of me getting sick are so slim, so I don't really care. But I also think we never dealt with it, right? So people, my generation and younger, of course, and even maybe the generation above me, they never saw it firsthand. So they don't understand the complications of it. And they feel like maybe people have been lying to them. I feel like sometimes that's how people feel about some of this stuff. It's like, oh, well, I didn't see it. So it didn't really happen. But sometimes we want to not think that way. We want to be more open-minded that there had to be a reason why we got rid of it in the first place. And it had to be pretty severe.
It's sort of like with measles, right? I mean, we can tell people about the huge number of children who have been saved from death over the years by vaccines, but it is so difficult to make the threat, which is real, feel real.
Yeah, I think some of the conspiracy part of it is just more that they've never seen this fly, they don't understand this fly, and they just feel like people are trying to scare them. And that's, you know, I think that a lot of that's been popping up since COVID, unfortunately. It's just, you know, the way the world is right now.
So what do we do? The best course is to shore up our barriers against the blowfly that creates screwworms so it stops where it is and starts to recede back to Panama from whence it came. Panama already releases millions of sterile blowflies every week, but it is no longer enough. So the U.S. is investing $21 million to renovate a fruit fly production facility in Mexico to produce up to 100 million additional sterile screwworm flies every week. And that still may not be enough, so another sterile fly factory will be built by the end of the year in Texas, on the border near Edinburgh at Moore Air Base. Sonia Swiger's role in all of this is to keep trying to educate folks as the danger grows more clear and more present.
I mean, the one thing is to know that this is a real fly. It does exist, and we want people to get educated on it. So I'm not out here trying to scare people, but it is getting closer, which is scary. I want people to know that is a concern. We're all concerned about it, and you don't usually see this much unity amongst different agencies unless it's something really important. We have weekly conversations with folks because we want people to know what's going on. Take the time to realize that this is a problem. And yes, it will be a problem for folks who live in an area with animals, more so than those that are probably in a more urban setting. But that doesn't mean it's not possible.
Right. And that's important to remember. Thank you so much, Sonia, for all this great information and for your time. Dr. Sonia Swiger is a professor in the Texas A&M University Department of Entomology. And I know everyone wants more information on the screwworm, and you can get that at the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension website. And also a group of livestock, wildlife, equine, horses, and landowner groups have formed a coalition called, aptly, the Screwworm Coalition of Texas. And it has a really informative website with a ton of valuable information at screwwormtx.org. And at that website, you can figure out how to quickly identify the screwworm, how to report suspicious flies, and learn more about this both as an economic issue and as a health issue. Because, as we like to say on this show, information is comforting, even if it's about a scary thing, because then you can make plans to protect yourself and those you love, even your fluffy white dogs. Which reminds me of a veterinarian named T.R. Lansford, who is on the Texas Animal Health Commission, recently sat on a panel at the Texas A&M Beef Cattle Short Course. I'm not sure what that is. It's important to beef cattle people. But he did say something that struck me. Quote, "We are not in crisis mode. We are in awareness and preparedness mode. So let's be aware and prepare." This episode of Petri Dish was produced by Jacob Rosati, TPR Vice President of News, Dan Katz, and me. I wrote the show, Jacob composed all the music, created the sound design, and edited the script. Yvette Benavides edited the story on TPR.org. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.